Good morning. How's your Monday going so far? Hope you're having a good day so far this morning. 10:06 is the time right now. Hi, and welcome to the second hour of our show. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Dr. Rob Thacker is getting set for another edition of Science Files this hour, our weekly look at news from the world of science. And I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, it's your turn to sound off this morning. We'll go to the phones for our first open hour of the week. We call it Manic Monday, and of course, anything goes next hour, and there's lots we can talk about. After the news at noon, we'll hear more about an auction that opens tomorrow, and Halifax historian Blair Beat is back with us this afternoon with another Halifax History Moment. But this hour, it is time for Science Files, and joining me in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist, Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
And how are you this fine Monday morning, sir?
Oh, pretty good. Term's over, but it's still pretty busy getting ready for finals. Students have already written a few. We started on Saturday, so
Busy That's time. That's a busy time, and sure, and getting close to the Christmas break, of course. And when's the university go for the Christmas break?
23rd, I think.
Okay. Yeah. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a science comment or question for Dr. Rob here this morning, you can also reach us via email, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a comment or a question or a Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show. And getting ready, I guess, to the most active meteor shower of the year, the Geminid meteor shower. In fact, it started on the 4th of this month. It'll peak on the 13th and 14th. That's Friday and Saturday nights. The problem, I'm told, is that it peaks we're up to 150 meteors an hour, but there's also a full moon this weekend.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, no, we won't be getting that this time around. So the full moon is, just, because it's so bright, I mean, you can't see the dimmer ones because the full moon is so bright. So, and you've got to have this, or get rid of this thing that we can see out of the window called cloud.
I know.
Right? And so, I don't know. We've got a front coming in with a lot of rain coming, right?
That's this week, but I think by Friday, the skies are expected to clear. So Saturday looks pretty good right now.
Okay. So we maybe. So if you want to see it, I mean, always point out to people, when it's cold especially, don't sit there in a deck chair with your neck crooked looking upwards. If you've got something you can lie on, that's always the best way to do it, especially if it's cold. Bundle up. If you're sitting still, you get cold much more quickly than if you're moving around. So if you're going to do this, don't put your neck in a bad position when it's very cold, because you'll wind up with a very stiff neck.
Good advice indeed. Yeah. I'm curious, though, this meteor shower is an every year thing.
Yep, absolutely.
So is this on the move, or is it the Earth that's...
So what you get is... this is the same for pretty much all meteor showers. What they're caused by is some kind of comet or object coming through that's, as it flies past, leaving this trail of debris behind it. So this debris is on a path that's effectively the same each time the comet comes around, because some of these comets come around very long periods, some of them come on shorter periods. And so what we're doing is each year we're going through that particular trail of material. And so it always looks as though it's on the same place in the sky, literally because it has essentially the same place as we go through it each year. So it's pretty cool, and there's a lot of them, obviously.
Yeah, and this is a meteor shower as opposed to a meteorite, and there's a specific difference here, right?
Right, so a meteor will be something that you see up in the sky, and then a meteorite will be something that can get down to the ground.
It actually hits the ground. Yeah. So, all right. And again, this peaks December 13th and 14th. That's Friday night, Saturday night. Again, aside from the full moon issue, we should be able to see upwards of 150 of these an hour.
Well, so the sad thing is, I mean, normally the Geminids are considered to be the most spectacular meteor shower of the year. So coinciding with the full moon is really kind of a little bit of a disappointment. But like I said, if we do have a clear sky, then you're going to see the really bright ones. So then it could be quiet. And so the best bets are probably one every couple of minutes, something like that.
Still, right? Be pretty neat to see. Yeah. And the advice here is to get to a dark sky location.
Oh, definitely.
And
yeah.
Within the city, that's pretty much impossible. So somewhere outside the city.
You could go down to Point Pleasant.
Okay.
Right. But I don't know whether there'll be anywhere open in the evening, because they close it at nighttime. But around that area, there's a little bit less light. In fact, I had a friend who used to live down in that area. And you could see that there was this what we call a light dome off to the northern area and to the south. It actually looked quite good.
Oh, okay. right? Yeah. But the dark sky, the best place in the province is Kedji, right?
Oh, absolutely. Kedji is definitely the best place. But it's a long way to go from the city.
That is. It's like a 2 hours. Yes,
but you can literally go like 20, 25 minutes out of town, especially going down onto the South Shore, nearby places down there, or even around Peggy's. I mean, the light pollution down there is actually much lower than it is here.
Yeah, it says here, take up to 30 minutes to allow your eyes to adjust to the relative darkness. That would.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I don't like admitting to this, but so I was driving on Friday and just coming out of the parking lot, and I didn't see someone till the last minute. They stopped, I stopped. Fortunately, I didn't hit them, and I knew the person as well. But the thing to remember is your eyes take time to adjust to darkness, right? So you immediately go from a bright environment to a dark environment. You can actually have this issue of not seeing the things because your eyes simply haven't opened up their pupils wide enough to let more light in. So give it a bit of time. It's slower than you think as you get older, especially. We tend to adapt much more quickly when we're younger. And in fact, our pupils can get a little bit wider when we're younger. It tends to be limited as you get older. So just something to do. But if you're going out there, have a hot flask of coffee or hot chocolate or whatever.
Or something.
And that makes it a lot more fun and enjoyable.
Yeah. So you can either try earlier in the evening when the moon is low in the east. It rises around 6 p.m. local time. Or you can try in the wee hours of the morning. They seem to be the best times here, according to this.
Yeah, I mean, I would... practicalities. I mean, it's always nice to see a sunrise. I really do feel that the light that you get at a sunrise is different from the light that you get at a sunset, because I think with a sunset, there's a lot more stuff that's actually sort of thrown up into the atmosphere by all of the activity, whereas when you've had things more quiet overnight, there's less particulate in the air, so you tend to get this slightly different quality of light for sunrises in the morning.
Okay. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. I saw a story on The Wire the other day, headlined, Whale Dies with 100-kilogram Ball of Plastic Trash in Its Stomach.
Oh, God.
A huge ball of nets, ropes, plastic cups, bags, gloves, packing straps, tubing were all found in this young male sperm whale stranded on a beach in Scotland that later died. And again, 100 kilograms of plastic in its stomach. And you point out that there's literally, again, a story, literally a million times more microplastic in our oceans than we realize.
Well, okay. So the headline is slightly misleading, but it is accurate. So what they're talking about is a study that's been done out of the Scripps Oceanographic Institute. And so we've talked about this before, that so we found sort of like microplastics, very small pieces of plastic in the ocean. And I think it was something like, I don't know, 10 pieces every liter or something like that. I can't remember the precise, maybe it was a meter cube. I can't remember the precise value. But anyway, so what the researchers figured out was that, you know, we may be missing some pieces of plastic that are actually much, much smaller than the filter size of our net. And so what can we do? So they said, well, we'll go and look at something that's kind of, considered to be a kind of plankton, so salps. And they looked at the stomach contents of the salps. Salps literally pump water through them constantly. So they're constantly filtering. And so they found there were much, much, much smaller pieces of plastic than the cutoff in previous studies. And so there is a lot more of the small pieces of plastic. Now, as soon as anything breaks up, you get a lot more smaller pieces than you do big pieces. Yeah, everyone knows that. You break a plate, you get a lot more small pieces than you do big pieces. And so it's the same with these microplastics. There are a lot more of the smaller pieces, in fact, potentially millions of times more of the smaller pieces than there are the bigger pieces. But their overall volume doesn't significantly change the actual amount of plastic. Now, that said, this is a serious issue because now we're realizing that these microplastics are impacting biota of all different sizes. It's not just the bigger things like the fish and so on that are going to get this. It's actually the really small things like the plankton and so on as well. So this is really a concern. And of course, the plankton
is the food that fish feed on.
It's the food that fish feed on, and they also poop, and then drop that poop, goes down, and then it gets recycled somewhere ocean floor, right? So all of this stuff is actually getting concentrated, and so that's a concern. Again, we don't know what the overall toxicity of these plastics are to marine life, but there's certainly some evidence that it's definitely harmful to some of them. Again, for humans, we're still trying to figure out the risk at the moment. So
well, there's another study that says plastic pollution has killed 500,000 hermit crabs. These crabs caught in basically traps of plastic waste.
Yeah, no, this one is absolutely shocking, because I've been on holiday in Belize. I think I've told you this story. And so one of the guides there said, I want to show you a beach. I want to show you something because you will not believe it. And so he drove us up in a boat and he showed us this beach, and it was literally like a foot deep with trash. Wow. And I'm like, where is this from? And he's like, this is from cruise liners dumping their waste.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what's happening with these particular hermit crabs is they come in and they see a nice little bottle. Hermit crabs don't have their own shell, so they need to find something to act as a shell. So they'll use other shells from other organisms and so on. And as they grow, they need to change their shell as well. So they'll sometimes use cast-offs from bigger hermit crabs as well. And so anything that smells of a hermit crab, they're kind of attracted to. This might be another good shell for me. And so what they found was one particular bottle had 560 dead hermit crabs in it.
Holy smokes.
Because it just stank of hermit crab, and they kept thinking, oh, maybe that's a good shell, right? So it's literally a trap for hermit crabs. So this is just really disconcerting. And I mean, okay, it's just a hermit crab and so on, but it's part of the food web, right? They play a significant role in oxygenating all of the, aerating the sand that they live in as well. So that impacts other biota too. So anyway, this is just really disturbing.
It truly is. And the next time, you know, somebody criticizes the move to ban plastic straws, for example, you just got to throw that kind of information out in their face, and that should shut them up. Because, I mean, again, a whale with a 100-kilogram ball of plastic trash in its stomach, 500,000 hermit crabs killed because of a plastic trap that they were caught in.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to do tons better on plastic. We really have. I mean, eliminating single-use plastics is just a first step forward. We've got to think about the big picture as well.
Indeed. Here's Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files on a Monday morning. Alexander, stay there. You're coming up. We've got Ken on hold as well. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with more with Dr. Rob right after this quick break. Coming now to 10:21 here on a Monday morning, Dr. Rob is with us, another edition of Science Files, and Alexander's giving us a call this morning. Hello, Alexander.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
We're doing
good,
fine,
thanks. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I just had a quick question on moon exploration. I read an article recently about an amateur astronomer who found the crash site of a recent probe. I think it was from India or something. Now, am I correct in thinking there's been 3 or 4 crashes over the last few years? And is there anything in common on why they keep crashing, or is it just common, some kind of engineering error?
Hey, you got it. I mean, it's literally rocket science. Things go wrong, particularly in the descent. So, yeah, these things happen.
In the 60s, we had actual people landing there. So were we just getting lucky, or were we?
Good question.
Well, so what you have to remember is the difference in the expenditure between the two. So Apollo was an extremely expensive mission. There was at peak NASA, there was 400,000 people employed by the agency or its subcontractors. Whereas nowadays, you're looking at basically 1/10 of that size. And so when you are looking at a moon mission now, you're looking at something that's literally running on like 1/100 of the money that Apollo was running on. So it won't have been tested as much. You can argue that there should be some level of technological maturity that means we should be able to do these things better. But space is not an easy environment to work in. I mean, the joke about it being rocket science does have some practical aspects. It's not easy to do. The moon, we've generally been more successful on than we have Mars. If you look at Mars, that's been a bit of a disaster for a number of missions. So the moon in general, we're not doing too bad.
Thanks so much, gentlemen.
No
problem.
Appreciate
the call, Anthony. Thank you. Did the was it the Indian lunar lander that crashed, or was it the Chinese one?
It's the
Israeli one. Okay. Yeah. And there are, again, India, China, Israel now. There are, what, 5 or 6 nations that are in the space hunt, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, any country nowadays can literally build a satellite, right? It's a question of, like, where do you go for the launch capability, right? And so there are a number of different countries that are like, that's basically Ukrainian technology behind that idea. So, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different countries that have the launch capability, right? And so we're just heading in that. New Zealand.
Has launch capability?
Yeah, they have their own Electron rocket, yeah. So, I mean, that's private. That's not actually funded by the government of New Zealand, but nonetheless, it's all around the world now, pretty much.
All right, back to the phones to go. Ken's on the line. Morning, Ken.
Hi, Rick and Rob.
Hey, Ken.
Two things, and I'm just getting a full grasp of this. Number one is the Starlink system, the Starlink internet satellite system.
Yep.
It's been in the media the past week like crazy, finally, thank God. Elon Musk is going to send up approximately in January 60 satellites every 2 weeks. And on the weekend, CBC did a whole special on the whole thing. And the goal is 120,000 satellites for this internet system. And then India and China are going to send up maybe approximately the same amount. It could be 500,000. And they talked about the whole Chilean, the telescope, and there's two down there. And it really affected their astronomy and their photography. And this is going to get incredibly worse. And I'm really concerned. Didn't know it was such a big deal till the past week.
Yep.
Rob, what the heck can we do to stop this?
We talked about this last week.
Yeah, we did talk about this.
Sorry.
That's all right. No, it's a good issue.
And then, as Rick knows, I mean, I brought this up 2 years ago when I first heard about OneWeb and Starlink plans. I will say I've not heard 120,000. I've heard up to 40,000 for Starlink. And practically, most people think it's probably going to be about 1,000 or 2,000, to be honest. Whether they'll go that high in terms of the total number remains to be seen. But absolutely, yes. A number of astronomers have already run simulations of what this would mean. And for the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which is the next sort of like major observatory being built down in Chile, this is going to be a huge issue. It basically means that 25% of the observing time in the summer there is going to be lost because there'll be too many streaks. And everyone says, well, you know, isn't internet important? Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. But there's other ways we can deliver it. And then they sort of say, well, you know, can't you just sort of like take out the tracks and so on? If it was just about a track in a photograph, then yes, we could. But the problem is the light from those satellites scatters in the telescope and scatters across the whole image plane. It's not just localized. It goes to end up being because of what are called ghost reflections within the optical train. And so this is a problem, right? And there's nothing that we can do really once the image is contaminated. That's it, pretty much. So, a real concern. Fortunately, Musk has accepted that this is an issue and is now actively working with a number of astronomy groups. In particular, already one very, very important research agency, I'll call it that, called AURA in the United States, has put out a statement about this. And SpaceX has responded by saying, yeah, okay, we'll do everything we can to make them less visible. So there is some hope. It's not perfect, but with basically putting, you could put blackened paint over the bottoms of these, that would help. Right. And so it's a concern. And so, but like I said, I'm not sure where we go from here. There's no international sort of like guidelines on this other than deorbiting, making sure there is a plan for how these things come down. That's actually all written up as part of the Starlink proposal.
Right? Appreciate the call, Ken. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
All right. Bye bye. And doesn't this complicate, again, space launches if all of these satellites are. Again, for the internet issue, for the Starlink thing, doesn't that complicate space launches from other missions and such?
People are going to be tracking where these things are. So, I mean, people launch windows already, people are concerned about where things are and so on. But the probability of having an impact on sort of like one day is pretty low. The problem with these things is over time, they cover so much area, then your probability of an impact goes up, right? Mm. So with these particular satellites, these are designed to fly comparatively low, not too high. And then after a period of a few years, then they're deorbited, they come back down to Earth and burn up. And they suggest they'll launch more, right? So there's a bit of an issue here in terms of like all of the sustainability of it all. But anyway, so yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, this is something that I'm a bit shocked that it's taken the astronomy community this long to get around to dealing with this. But nonetheless, there we are. Here we are.
So what is needed then? Government intervention here? Or
yeah, there's going to have to be some kind of regulation of this, I think. There's no getting away from it. Because, I mean, yes, I'm not going to be someone who doesn't say global internet isn't important. Yes, it absolutely is, right? And I'm not going to say, oh, you should stop it because it's messing up astronomy. We have to work together. Right, that's the key point.
He is Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files on a Monday morning. It's 10:28 right now. We're going to take a break here for a news update. Then more with Dr. Rob. And if you've got a question, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back with more Science Files after the news. And the news is coming up next. Science Files here on a Monday morning, 10:33 is the time. Dr. Rob Thacker is with us in the studio, as always. He's an astrophysicist with St. Mary's University here in Halifax. And if you've got a comment or a question, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Good morning, Rick.
Hey, good morning. Morning, Dr. Rob.
Hey, Rick.
Quick question regarding peer review.
Okay.
If Dr. Rob writes a paper and sends it out for peer review, who decides who gets it? That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, is it exactly the same procedure in all disciplines, or are they a little different? And what happens if the peer review, if errors are found in it? Do the people who find the errors go back to the person who wrote the paper and point out the errors, and then they try to, you know, figure it out?
Sure.
That's the way it all works. Am I correct in that?
Yep. So okay. peer reviewing, just for the people who don't know. So this is the way people assess whether scientific publications are, the best I can say, is accurate and precise, right? Not necessarily do they have the right answer, because that may not always be the question that's being dealt with, but are they working as best as they could? And so the reviewer will be sent the paper by the editor of a journal. So editors of scientific journals are responsible for basically keeping a list of people who are known experts that you can send a paper to and have them look at it and say, does this actually follow logically? Are the arguments sound? And so on. And so very often, and I will say this has certainly happened to me, this has happened to everyone I know in science, you write something in a paper or you have an argument in the paper and it's not quite right. Right, I'm not going to say wrong, but not quite right. So then it will be the referee's job to point out those errors or inconsistencies or whatever, and they will do, or they will produce what's called the referee's report. And the referee's report can be as short as like a paragraph. It is a really excellent paper, and there's hardly anything wrong with it, which is very, very, very rare. Okay, that hardly ever happens. And so the alternative is sort of like a longer, more lengthy report, which, and I've had reports of up to like 2 or 3 pages in some case, full of concerns. And so if it's a really, really bad paper and the referee can't see anything that they think is potentially relevant or interesting or whatever, then they can recommend rejection of the paper to the editor as well. But obviously, if you do that, then you have to have a very concise reasoning for why you do that. And so that report is then sent back to the editor, and the editor looks at that report, goes over it, decides whether they think it's okay or not, and then they will forward that back to the person who wrote the paper, and then it will be sent back with some instructions of what the editor expects. And so if the editor says, you know, here's the report, this paper is a piece of garbage, it's all wrong, we don't want to see it again, right, then that means that's it, right? You don't get to submit a revised version. What happens most of the time is the referee's report will be sent back, and the editor will say something like, we would be prepared to see a revised version of the paper after you have addressed all of these issues in the referee's report. And so that is the general process by which happens. You go and make changes, you try and address things. Sometimes you can't always do what a referee asks for, and then you have to provide an argument for why you can't do that. Like, they might ask for a whole new suite of simulations that would take a year to do. And if that's going to be the case, then probably you're not going to do that. You'd start a different research project.
Right.
So
writing a paper, are we, Rick?
Yeah, so
Great,
so the general process is the same across all scientific fields at a very general level, but the number of referees involved, what they consider to be, like, I know in my wife's field, the overall way the paper is put together and the editorial standards of the paper are taken a lot more seriously than in my field. In my field, we focus very much strongly on the physics and the arguments, whereas in my wife's field, which is biology and environmental science, then making sure that absolutely everything is properly cited, absolutely everything is written appropriately, is a very big thing in that field and something that they take very seriously. So there are slightly different standards from field to field, but by and large, the overall process is pretty much the same.
Mm, okay.
Thanks.
All right. Appreciate the call, Rick. Thanks very much. Let's go to Harry next year this morning. Hi, Harry.
Hi, thanks for this wonderful show, Rick. Fantastic.
Well, no problem. Thanks for the call here. You got a question for Dr. Rob?
Yes, I do. It's I normally would never talk about something like this in public, perhaps to the government, but nowhere else. But now that it's public knowledge, I will. Recently, we've seen over the last year things we've been working on with metamaterials. The first example of what would before being considered impossible is now we saw them take an iron hockey puck and surround it with a cylinder of metamaterial. It looks just like paper. And they shone radio waves at it. And from whatever angle you looked at it, the puck ostensibly disappeared behind, sideways, any angle. And then they've shown it recently with, they said it would come with visible light. And I think it was a Canadian, it was on the news, held up a cloak and he disappeared. The light went right around him. Sounds all fine and dandy. My question is technology, and I'm not a Luddite, I'm a Promethean, but the point is technology overtaking the survival of humanity and life on this planet? Because when you have incoming ICBMs and you paint them with a metamaterial like that, they now become invisible to radar.
Sorry, Harry, you said you were a what?
I'm a Promethean. I think that's the right word. That's the ones who believe in the process of science being an advancement of knowledge as being a positive thing as compared to a Luddite, which compares things, you know. It's the opposite of a Luddite. My point is also that that's not just that example, which is very serious, but also we now have the advancement of hypersonic and adjustable in-flight hypersonic incoming missile technology, and this has to do with astrophysics in a way. It's not way out there, but it's certainly close enough to be astrophysics and far enough away to be astrophysics. The other aspect is also less astrophysics, more physical, and that is when you have with Putin, and I'm sure we have also cruise missiles that are nuclear-powered cruise missiles with a nuclear warhead, meaning they, because of nuclear power, they can travel for days and days as opposed to a few minutes before they hit a target.
All right,
you never know where they are because they're flying beneath radar.
Let's hear what Dr. Rob has to say about this.
So the general concern that technology makes the world a more dangerous place is probably not an unreasonable suggestion. Right, and so we've lived with the doctrine of mutually assured destruction now since the late 50s, right?
Yep.
And so we are not, as a species, in a particularly comfortable position. But that is something that we know, and that is something that we have to deal with, although, who knows, maybe the big filter of why we don't see lots and lots of evidence of life in the universe is because civilizations blow themselves up. I mean, that's a very sort of negative viewpoint, but anyway. So with the metamaterials, coming back to something that I've seen a little bit about. So yes, I have definitely seen examples of metamaterials that are basically very, very clever things that essentially perfectly pass a field around them. And so these things have been shown at radio waves. I think they're getting to shorter and shorter wavelengths. And so to get down to visible light would be a significant improvement. And so I haven't heard of materials that anyone's developing that can do it at light wavelengths, but I'm not going to say because I don't know. So maybe someone is developing something or thinking about how you would do that. It seems very, very difficult to me, but nonetheless, who knows? There are very smart people out there. And so does this act as some kind of stealth technology? Yes, you conceivably could do that, but we already have stealth technologies, right? And so with missiles, the thing to remember with missiles is they are always leaving a strong heat signature. There's no getting away from it because exhausts are hot. So while you may be able to sort of like prevent them being detected from radio signals, remember radar. So remember that they have heat signatures, and the heat signatures are the thing that you're going to use. And so from that perspective, I'm not too concerned about these things. But as a general sort of like thing, as a general phenomenon, yes, technology does make the world a potentially more dangerous place to live. I mean, look at cars, for heaven's sake, right? Cars, here you have something you're driving, like close to a ton vehicle, right? And if you lose or forget to pay attention to the road, then you can accidentally kill people, right? So, yeah, we don't live in a perfectly safe society, but then we will never live in a perfectly safe society either. And we have to deal with what's called acceptable risk. And the question that we have now is, are all of these new military technologies taking us beyond to a position where we have acceptable risk from those? Well, I don't know. I mean, we have to deal with this all the time, and we protect ourselves from one another with military technology. It's meant to be defensive, not offensive, but nonetheless, of course, there are crazy people in the world every now and again.
But he kind of suggested a cloak of invisibility here. I mean,
yeah, so that's what I'm saying. With the metamaterials, so the radio wavelength materials, so they actually pass the radio waves around them and out on the other side, if you think about it that way. So the idea would be if you can do the same thing with light, because light is just a much, much, much shorter wavelength version of radio waves. It's all what's called electromagnetic radiation. Then you could, in theory, create a cloaking device. And so they've done this with, I think they may have done it just in the infrared part of the spectrum, far away from the visible portion of it. But it's a question of you have to sort of like continually miniaturize the technology to make it actually work with shorter and shorter wavelengths.
So a commercial on television the other day, a truck commercial, and it was, I can't remember if it was a GMC or Ford, whatever it was, but it was hauling a trailer, and it's got this new device that you can, even if you're hauling a trailer, it will look beyond that trailer to see what's behind the trailer. And as you look into the monitor that you can look behind you at, the trailer's not there. You just see...
So you can do that if
you're moving. So they made the trailer invisible.
Well, if you're moving, you can predict what's there.
Okay.
Right? So if you have different viewpoints, you can predict what would be there. Right?
So
that's the thing to remember.
Okay. So this is not really an invisible trailer here.
No, you can't suddenly make a trailer invisible. You could obviously put the camera on the back of the trailer.
But it doesn't do that, no.
Right. Okay, so then in that situation, then as long as you have a different viewpoint, right, that gives you a viewpoint of what is actually out there, then you can predict as you move what your new viewpoint would be.
Harry, I hope that answers your question.
Question, what about the Boris Yeltsin incident in 1997, where when we were at great peace with the Russians at that time, we told them we were sending up a sounding rocket. They interpreted it as an EMP attack. And for the first time, they opened their football. We'd opened up ours a couple of times. And they said to Boris Yeltsin, you have 3 minutes to launch everything. And the Soviet system, the Russian system, has a dead man switch. If they fire one thing, they fire everything. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is not a joke. I don't know if he's drunk or sober. They should make him into a saint, because he sat for 3 minutes and then he said, "Nyet," and they closed the football. Or we wouldn't be talking, guys.
Yep.
So what about accidents? I mean, never mind, you can believe in technology, but what are we doing to prevent an accident?
Question, Harry. Thanks.
I know someone who used to work in the defense, and so there was a very, very significant concern, ironically, in the late 90s, that we were getting closer and closer to having a standoff because the time of response was getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And the more pressure people are under, the more likely they are to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And so as the windows were getting shorter, there was a real concern that actually dealing with this was actually going to promote some kind of accident because of that.
Haven't they moved the doomsday clock a little closer to midnight?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different assessments for that. I mean, I still think that, if I'm completely frank, I mean, yes, I accept that nuclear disaster would be obviously a horrendous thing for humanity and would probably be the end of pretty much all of us. But at the end of the day, we've lived with that for several decades now.
Yep.
Right? Now, you can argue that Putin is destabilizing societies. I mean, they've realized that free societies can be destabilized by very, very subtle pushes, right? And we're seeing this in social media, right? There was an amazing study coming out of Clemson University on a number of Russian bots. And so what they do is they actually get followers by posting lots of nice stuff. And then once they have lots and lots of followers, then they start posting the bad stuff and trying to create division, right? And so how do you create division in an open society? You literally go out and say bad stuff.
That's something the Americans are struggling with now as they head toward the 2020 vote as to how they prevent this influence from foreign nations.
So at the end of the day, yes, I am concerned about military technologies and the proliferation of military technologies. I am more concerned in that perspective of like rogue groups getting nuclear weapons and then creating some kind of incident because of that, to be quite frank. But yeah, I accept the concern. It hasn't gone away. It's still there. But we have an immediate thing that we do know about, and that's climate change, and we have to do something about that as well.
As I was growing up as a teenager and such over in Germany, at the height of the Cold War and the fear that, Russian tanks would be rolling over the plains of Germany at the time, and I mean, the Cold War is, you know, this is just a different version that we're in today here. And that threat has always been hanging over us here.
Well, I mean, it's always been there. And there are obviously technologies at the disposal of a number of countries that would cause enormous damage to the Earth. Right?
10:48 is the time. Dr. Rob Thacker in Science Files here on a Monday morning. And if you've got a question for us, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We're back with more with Dr. Rob right after this quick break. 10:51 our time here right now on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob has been checking out potential nuclear war that I guess it's avoided only at the last second here.
This is called the Norwegian rocket incident, and it's 1995, not 97, but close enough. So, ironically, it was a Black Brant rocket, which is a technology that Canada has been involved in developing. It's a what's the company? Magellan Aerospace.
Right.
And so this was launched out of Norway. And so the satellite went up. It was a four-stage rocket, so bits and pieces are coming off it as it gets higher and higher and higher. And the Russian forces thought, well, this looks just like a U.S. Trident launch. And so they didn't quite track it in the right direction either. And so literally the nuclear briefcase was presented to Yeltsin, right? And he had to make a decision on what to do. So this is, yeah, completely true.
Wow.
Yeah.
Again, scary when you really think about how close
we... I am amazed that I haven't heard about this before,
Nor I.
Wow.
I mean, the one story we hear about how close the two countries came with the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, but...
Everyone has heard about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yeah. You can't not have heard about the Cuban Missile Crisis, really, unless you're obviously very young. But, I mean, certainly my generation heard about this because whenever we talked about the Cold War, everyone said, we got so close here because the tension just went up and up and up with the barricade and everything.
Well, we lived in an army base in Manitoba at the time, army personnel came door to door, the PMQs, warning parents to go to the basement, stockpile food down there, and be prepared. Yeah. I mean, that's how close we were.
Well,
10:52 is the time. Let's go to Bob on the line here this morning. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Good, how are you doing?
Good. It was an interesting story about the whale. By the way,
yeah,
I gotta say,
but
on about the same timeline, I guess you read that last week sometime.
The whale story, this came out last week.
Yeah. On the same timeline was the story about the West Coast cougars being poisoned by mercury. Have you read that one?
No, I hadn't seen that.
That's a pretty interesting one because it deals with tectonics. And the article I read, anyway, explained that because of seismic activity in the Pacific, it's releasing this toxin into the ocean, which somehow chemically changes into mercury in the fog going onto the West Coast, poisoning all those cats, the mountain lions.
Well, Dr. Rob, have you heard anything about this at all?
I haven't heard about this, although I probably should, bearing in mind that my wife actually works in mercury pollution poisoning. So there are a number of natural sources of mercury. You can have, for example, decay of material, it's basically organic material in... a watershed that will actually end up concentrating the mercury. That happens. I mean, there are sort of like really natural occurring ways for mercury to get concentrated. But this is different by the sound of it. This was actually coming from fog or something like that.
Yeah, fog and tectonic activity in the Pacific. Interestingly enough, what happened in New Zealand today, isn't that weird?
Yeah, the volcanic eruption with the
absolutely.
Tourists. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This was, again, the active volcano site that was also a tourist draw. And there are a number of tourists from a cruise ship that were touring this morning when the volcano erupted. And they don't know how many are dead yet, but a number of people killed
as a result of it. No, there's at least five reported dead.
At least five, but I think a number are missing and unaccounted for. So,
I mean, they're suggesting there won't be any survivors of people who are
probably
on the island.
Probably not, no. Yeah,
it was a pretty big explosion. But it's interesting, the planet is definitely changing. We can see that in our weather, can't we?
No question.
Oh, for sure.
Appreciate the call, Bob. Thanks very much. 10:54 is the time. I read something interesting about idling. Here it says, Natural Resources Canada says, if most Canadian drivers limited their idling to 3 minutes a day over the course of a year, 1.4 million fewer tons of CO2 emissions would go into the atmosphere. And for every 10 minutes of idling, the average 3-liter engine vehicle loses more than a liter of fuel, according, again, to the Natural Resources Canada agency. And it's even worse with diesel buses. We had a chat with
Councillor
Zareski and Mason this morning about our diesel buses and whether or not we should be moving toward more electrical buses, for example.
Yeah, I mean, the people know, like, you drive a hybrid and you sort of get up to the stop sign and you stop, everything goes off,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's obviously a good thing to actually be able to turn an engine off, an internal combustion engine off, if you can. And so this is just a further example of that. I mean, I would say that you got to be, I'm all for technologies cutting down on emissions and so on, but you have to put that however many millions it was in context of the overall emissions over the year. And while we have to sort of make improvements, you don't want like 0.1% improvements and stand up and say, yeah, we've really sorted this out, because it doesn't make any really big difference at the end of the day.
Mm.
Right. So with electric cars, I know we've had this debate before on the show about like whether does this actually change the overall emissions. And so the thing to remember with electric cars, though, is as the generation of electricity goes to more renewable sources, then inevitably electric cars also get cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. That's the key point that you have to remember. If you produce your power via dirty methods, like you're burning coal and you're burning oil, then you're right. You're actually just moving where you produce the emissions to the power station away from the car, right? So that's always a concern, right? But the point with electric cars and so on is that if you have clean generation, you then just pass that power on and you have clean transport as well.
Yeah, the problem that we have with our buses is that electric buses are exorbitantly priced right now and not affordable for most communities.
Yeah.
And Zarowski mentioned perhaps an overhead system like back in the day.
Yeah. I mean, like old trams, right? So
yeah.
I genuinely believe that electric buses are going to come down in price. It's for them, the question is, you need such huge batteries that inevitably the battery cost is very high, right? And so that's got to get better at some point. And as we know, there are some jurisdictions that have taken it upon themselves to put electric buses in play. And to be quite frank, the emissions from diesel buses are pretty significant. So doing or moving to some kind of electric bus would be a nice thing to do.
All right. The hour is up. But Dr. Rob, it flies right by every time you drop by. And again, thank you very
much. Always a pleasure. Bit of a sort of like a serious hour over the past
morning. We're all going to die, apparently, soon.
Well, we are all going to die. True.
We didn't get into this giant star symbol. Anyway, we'll talk about that next time.
We'll talk about it next week. Yeah, for sure.
All right, Dr. Rob, thanks very much. And it is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update here, and then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday. Anything goes in our open hours, and our phone lines await your calls now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Got something to say this morning? We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. We'll take your calls after the news, and it is coming up next.